Is it the end of an era or a temporary setback? While some races have yet to be decided, Democrats are poised to complete their sweep today. Republican Senator George Allen of Virginia may be about to become the last of six Republican incumbent senators to lose re-election bids in Tuesday's midterm elections, which were marked by deep dissatisfaction with the president and the war in Iraq. It's hard to read that vote as anything but a corrective message. 25 years after Ronald Reagan came to Washington, 12 years after the Gingrich Revolution, and 6 years after Republicans took control of the White House and both houses of Congress, 2006 may mark the end of an era when conservative ideas drove the national agenda. The question for conservatives and liberals alike is, what now? Power often leads to overreach. It wasn't all that long ago when Republican strategists spoke confidently of a permanent majority. New speaker-in-waiting Nancy Pelosi claimed the vote was meant to take our country in a new direction, but a repudiation of the Bush administration and the war in Iraq may not translate into an endorsement of a Democratic agenda. This hour, we'll talk with conservatives and liberals about what happened to both political parties on Tuesday and how their ideologies may change. Later in the hour, we'll talk with FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein about the FCC's new rulings on profanity. But first, we want to hear from you. Did the Democrats win or the Republicans lose? Should Democrats work with the president when they can or oppose him at every turn? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. Joining us now is Adrian Woolridge, the Washington bureau chief of The Economist magazine, co-author of The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program, Adrian.
Thank you.
Is this truly a significant shift, do you think?
Well, I'm trying to write a new book called The Left Nation. Not quite. I don't think it's a significant shift. What it is a corrective and a reassertion of the power of the center. People aren't saying we want to move dramatically to the left, but what they're saying is that the Republican Party and the conservative movement just try to take us too far to the right, and we don't want any more marching in that direction.
Mm-hmm. So what message should we take? I mean, you see all kinds of commentators from the right saying, we lost our way in the wilderness of the Washington bureaucracy. We became, well, like Democrats, we got fat and happy and forgot our good conservative values.
I think there's some truth in that. What we see here is partly a rejection of incumbency. These are people who lost their ideas and became just concerned with being insiders, with doling out pork, with doling out committee chairmanships. So it's partly that, but there is something more here, and that is that there is a rejection of a particular set of ideas, and that is the neoconservative ideas that led to the Iraq War. Bush has been in some ways a very ideological president, not just a White House insider, but somebody who took the country in a really new direction. And I think the whole idea of destroying rogue states, asserting American power, using American military force to change the balance of power in this or that area of the world. These were ideas. These weren't things that were pushed for by the permanent bureaucracy. These were things that were pushed for by a very identifiable group of conservative intellectuals. And what we have seen is those ideas leading to a morass in Iraq and the voters going to the polls and saying, look, this is a mess. We don't want any more of it. Mm-hmm. So it is an ideological defeat as well as a defeat for incumbents.
Mm-hmm. For many years, conservatives argued that their side enjoyed the ideological fervor, that the ideas that were, even during the Clinton administration, welfare reform, for example, that these were generated from the right. Yesterday and after Tuesday of this week, they seem to be on the defensive.
The right is on the defensive. I think certainly the neoconservative movement is on the defensive. I'm not sure that what we see is a terrible ferment of ideas on the left, however. What we see is a very good set of policy proposals by Nancy Pelosi, very sensible, centrist set of ideas, but not a real identity, not a real ideological identity in the way that you got with Newt Gingrich. I applaud that. My worry is that you will get a new ideological movement, which will be an attempt to redefine centrism in a very different way from the way that Clinton defined it. And that will be, shall I call it, Lou Dobbsism. This will be protectionism, building up walls against immigrants, building up walls against trade, and taking a culturally conservative position, sort of a left-wing Buchananism, as it were. I see some signs of that.
Coming out of the Democratic Party.
Yes, coming out of the Democratic Party. Because they're trying to become a less of a liberal party, more of a national party. They're trying to become less of a fringe party, more of a centrist party. The real question that we're going to see debated over the next few months, I think, is what is this new centrism?
Well, at the same time, as I was talking about the conservatives saying we lost our way and that we have to get back to true conservatives, you also see progressives arguing that, no, it wasn't the conservative Democrats who won this election. It was progressives who won this election. They were the fervor behind getting people to the polls and getting people excited about this election.
Sure, you see people arguing that. I think the case of Ned Lamont doesn't necessarily demonstrate. I think the really interesting thing that happened from the Democratic point of view is
Ned Lamont, the anti-war insurgent who upset Joe Lieberman in Connecticut, but then lost to him as an independent in the general election on Tuesday.
Exactly right. I think what you're seeing is the fact that they're making inroads into places like Iowa and Idaho and Kansas. The fact that they are more of a centrist party, that they're willing to, or more of a big tent party, shall I say? They're not a culturally elitist party. They're trying not to be, and I think that Nancy Pelosi has tried to produce an agenda which is as broad, I don't want to call it banal, but it's not exactly full of cutting-edge ideas. It's as broad as you can be in order to try and hold this big tent party together.
Let's get some callers involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Neil. Neil calling us from San Antonio, Texas.
Yes, how are y'all?
Very well, thanks.
Very good. I was just calling to tell you that I'm consider myself conservative, but I voted straight libertarian this time just because I've really gotten kind of turned off by the fact that Bush hadn't stayed the course on a lot of conservative ideas. I was very disappointed in his position on the steel tariffs, the softwood lumber tariffs. Medical benefits that haven't been paid for, the cost of war, the ballooning budget deficit, and it seems to me that every time there's a chance to spend money, they do. And I'm hoping, everybody's saying that it's a referendum on the war, and I'm looking at it as more a referendum on stop the spending.
Mm-hmm.
And let's get under our financial house under control, or we're all going to be in trouble.
No, yes,
what y'all thought.
Adrian Woolridge, the Republican Party used to be the party of a small government and low taxes. We've got the low taxes, but small government, no, that's not true.
Exactly. I think what George Bush tried to do in order to broaden the conservative and the Republican coalition was to create something which has been termed big government conservatism. This was trying to use the power of government to push for conservative ends. And this election was very much a repudiation of that. We have Rick Santorum, who was a man who believed in big government and using that government for socially conservative ends, going down to a really spectacular defeat in Pennsylvania. I think for an incumbent senator who's part of a party leadership to lose by more than 14 points is very dramatic. It's not being given the attention it should have been. So I think what we've seen is that big government conservatism alienates real conservatives, small government conservatives, without winning over the sort of swing voters that it's intended to win over. So I think that we're seeing the terminus of that particular movement for a while at least.
And Neil, you weren't convinced by the talk of fiscal austerity on the part of the Democrats?
They haven't proved it before. And I think everybody was saying what a great job Clinton did, but I really believe that income grew into his budget, not that the budget decreased or there was any decrease in spending.
Well, there were losses, real losses, in the number of people who worked for the government during the Clinton administration, and that did reverse in the Bush administration, Neil. But anyway.
Yes, that's true. But if you look, I bet you the overall expenditures actually went up.
Yeah, I think that's true of the Reagan administration, too.
That's,
but
that's
let's not fight old battles.
But that may be,
what could Reagan do when you had a Democratic Congress?
Exactly.
I wish Reagan had a Republican Congress is really what I wish could have happened.
All right, Neil. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Let's get Francine on. Francine from Denver, Colorado.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a red state that went purple this time and mm-hmm. swung the congressional districts from 4-3 Republican to 3-4 Democrat. I think the end of an era is definitely in place, but it wasn't just the war in Iraq, and I think the Democrats are going to be wrong if they get co-opted by Bush. his habit is to make statements in public and then act completely different in private. If they stick just to Iraq, which is a total quagmire no matter who's in office, we're going to lose the 2008 presidential election. I think people voted also because they're tired of the religious right ruling the country. And in Colorado, we have Focus on the Family, and the Republican Party is way, way right. Get back to science as a principle of objectively analyzing problems. And everyone is called a liberal out here. Every Democrat who runs, no matter what they think, is tagged a liberal, so you might as well live up to the name a bit. And I think any Democrat who ran this time, contrary to the beliefs of the Democratic Party in my state, would have won. And many people almost won. So I think if I were a Republican strategist, I'd definitely draw the Democrats in on Iraq, and thereby losing that momentum for change. And if I were a Democrat, I would really concentrate on the old-fashioned, Democratic wing of the Democratic Party and redefine the center, because the center has got, we talk about this as the center, but actually 20 Democrat, pro-choice Democrats replaced anti-choice Republicans, and that's actually something that no Democrat is talking about.
Mm-hmm. I don't mean to cut you off, Francine, but I wanted to give Adrian Wooldridge a chance to reply before the break.
Well, I think it's very interesting what has happened in Colorado and in the West, that we have a Democratic trend, and we could be seeing the beginning of a lot of Western states going the way that California has gone, because the West tends to be socially liberal. If it's economically conservative, it's also socially liberal. And so I think that's an extremely worrying sign from the Republican point of view. They could become the party of the South that finds it very difficult to, impossible, of course, to win over the Northeast, but also very difficult to win over the West. So Colorado is certainly a state that needs to be carefully watched.
Mm-hmm. Francine, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And Adrian Wooldridge, we appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you very much.
Adrian
indeed.
Wooldridge, the Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist magazine, co-author of The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. When we come back from a break, we'll take more of your calls on this issue as we continue the conversation. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where earlier today, President Bush promised his administration would rise above partisan differences after voters handed control of the House of Representatives and maybe the U.S. Senate to the Democrats. Speaking at the White House, he also said he's open to any idea or suggestion on Iraq. And in Montana, incumbent Republican Senator Conrad Burns conceded defeat to Democrat John Tester. Republican George Allen, trailing his Democratic opponent in Virginia, is expected to speak in about 40 minutes. Today, we're talking about this shift in American politics, what some call the end of an era where conservative ideas dominated the national agenda. Did the Democrats win on Tuesday, or did the Republicans lose? Should Democrats work with the president where they can or oppose him at every turn? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. Matt Bai writes on national politics for the New York Times Magazine and is working on a book about the changes in the Democratic Party. He joins us now by phone from his office here in Washington. Good to speak with you, Matt.
Hey, Neil. Nice to talk to you again.
And I think you got a new chapter.
Well, I got too many chapters, but that's a different conversation.
Is this the end of an era?
No, I don't think it is, and I'm going to take a slightly different tack from your last guest, because I think this is an important point. We tend to keep talking about this in terms of liberal versus conservative or Democratic versus Republican. We had a Republican wave. Now that era is over. We have a Democratic wave. The West was Republican. Now it's going Democrat. I would rather suggest to you that what we're seeing is the same continuum in American politics, and it's not best viewed as a conservative and liberal axis. It's best viewed as an anti-Washington versus governing conflict. And that essentially what voters have been saying in this country increasingly for decades is that nothing is getting done to sort of turn us toward a 21st century world, that nothing alleviates the economic insecurity and the insecurity they now have about foreign policy in the world, that they don't believe that either party is addressing those concerns. And so what we have is the parties in power being turned out because they simply don't modernize or look forward. They're still having these two parties, the same fight they were having in 1975, and it means nothing to people. So the wave of 1994 versus the wave of 2006 can be seen as two separate waves of two separate ideological tilts of the country, but I would suggest they're not. I would suggest it's the same wave, and that, in fact, as you were just talking about, you know, the West, say Colorado, used to be conservative, suddenly it's going liberal. I would suggest to you that it used to be anti-government, and now it's anti-government.
Ah, so
and it just depends on who's governing.
The good news for Democrats is you won, and the bad news is you won.
That's precisely right. The bad news is people expect something of you, and if you don't deliver it, which, you know, for reasons we can get into, I think structurally they can't, then you're bound to be in the same situation again, because what people are registering here is an exhaustion with 20th century politics in a 21st century environment.
One of the things that we talked a lot about, I think the last time you were on the program, was the battle between two electoral campaign tactics that the Democrats were talking about. Rahm Emanuel, the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Committee, wanted to spend all the money possible to win individual races around the country, seeing this as an historic opportunity to get back control of the House of Representatives. And then you had Howard Dean, at the chairman of the party, who wanted to use the 50-state strategy to build up the party in places where it had virtually evaporated, Alaska, for example, and reestablish the Democrats as a national party. Did they both win?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very hard to parse that. It's very hard to say, well, this guy was right or that guy was right. And I think, you know, it was hard. I wrote about this in a cover story several weeks ago, and it was hard to come down on one side or the other then, and I think it is. I don't think the election made that any clearer. I mean, certainly, Rahm Emanuel, forgive me for that, Neil, that's my phone line clicking.
Okay.
Certainly, Rahm Emanuel deserves most of the credit, I would think, of everyone you can talk about in this campaign, because the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee did a fantastic job of recruiting candidates, the right kind of candidates, and a very good job of targeting races. But it's also true, I think Governor Dean can claim some success, and then a lot of the states where he has spent money on his 50-state strategy, they had a very strong turnout and a very strong a very strong activist involvement, which mm-hmm. He certainly can reasonably claim to have fueled that. But I think in both cases, I will put it this way, in both cases, I think neither of them are the winners they'll claim to be, because the real driver here was Republican government and voter fatigue and exhaustion with the style as much as the substance of Republican government in Washington. And I think that it was a great year if you were a leader of Democratic Campaign Committee or the Democratic Party to look awfully smart as a result of what your opponents were doing rather than what you were doing.
Mm-hmm. Here's a phone call. Cheryl joins us from Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
I agree on so many levels with what the gentleman before me just said. I'm a firm Republican. I feel I'm very conservative in my views, but I did vote Democratic because I felt like Washington just was not listening. I heard a statement from President Bush when he was questioned about retaining Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, where his answer was something to the order of, it's
your line is breaking up, Cheryl. Let's try it again. And the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and he was until yesterday.
I'm sorry, one more time?
He's Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. Your line was breaking up. Let's try it again.
Okay. With Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, where he says, you know, it's my decision. Basically, I'm the boss, I'm in charge, and this is my decision, and everybody else has to stick with it.
I'm the decider, is, I think, the quote everybody remembers from that.
Yeah, and it's not. He is a representative of the people. And that's why I voted for Bush, was I felt like he was a free person. He wasn't a positive speaker. He was an
Cheryl, your line is just too difficult to hear, and I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go. But Matt Bai, I think everybody remembers voters like Cheryl in New Hampshire delivered a critical state to George W. Bush.
Yeah, and see, now my clicking in phone doesn't seem so bad.
No, it doesn't.
You know what? You know, this goes to the heart of what I was just saying. I don't mean to be a one-note song on this, but I think that's exactly right. And again, we have a policy and a political establishment that I really believe is thinking about politics in terms that are no longer entirely relevant. And we as a media institution do this too. So, you know, they will think about people like Cheryl in Portsmouth as being a Republican voter. She therefore becomes a base voter, right? She's a Republican, she's part of the red team, and she's always going to vote red. American voters just don't look at it that way anymore. It's a very different world. They're not party identified. Independents are growing much faster than either of the two parties are. You know, she may vote Republican for four or five straight elections, but that doesn't make her Republican, and it doesn't mean she's satisfied with the direction of government. And I think what people really want, some vision that goes beyond euphemisms and rhetoric, of how to fix some very intractable problems and serious challenges, and I don't think they consider themselves part of a team.
Matt Bai, thanks very much.
Anytime, Neil.
Matt Bai writes on national politics for the New York Times Magazine, working now on a book about changes in the Democratic Party. He joined us by phone from his office. Let's go now to Peter Beinart, editor of The New Republic and author of The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. He's with us by phone from his office in town here today. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And what do you think? Do you think that this is a significant shift?
I think that Matt is right. Sorry to be so monotonous, but this was a referendum on George W. Bush and the Republican Congress. In 2004, the Democrats tried to make the presidential election a referendum, and Bush and Rove were successful in making it a choice, and there were enough people who were unhappy with Bush, who also had anxieties about Kerry, that Bush was able to get reelected. But a midterm election, much more than a presidential election, really is a referendum, particularly when one party controls all of the institutions of government. And so all of the Democrats really had to do, I think, was show up and make a few intelligent tactical decisions, and the enormous frustration and anger towards the Republican Party, kind of made the difference.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, here's an email we got from Stephen in Phoenix. I'm a lifelong Republican who voted Demo this time, not because I've become a liberal, but because I think President Bush is an incompetent, and my Senator John Kyle agreed with the president too much, and the GOP is too arrogant. But the Dems have the same problems they have had for decades. Their base is smaller than the GOP base. It is harder for them to energize their base without alienating the center than it is for the GOP. And the GOP is the party of ideas, even if them rather do turn out to be bad ideas. The Dems have no new ideas at all, except things like gay marriage, which I don't oppose, which doesn't excite me. All their other ideas, protectionism, minimum wage, etc., are right out of the 1930s.
Well, I don't think it's quite fair to say these ideas are right out of the 1930s. The ideas the Democrats want to push forward, things like the minimum wage, making it easier to pay for college, these are good ideas. But right now, what the Democratic Party still doesn't have is a larger narrative within which to understand why these things are important. What the Democratic Party still has to do, which Bill Clinton did in 1992, is tell Americans a story about the world which explains what's happening in their own lives, explains the rising economic insecurity that many middle-class Americans are facing, and then gives an explanation about how a more active government, not a bloated government, but an active, effective government, can empower people and allow them to succeed in this often quite destabilizing new global economy. That, I think, is the kind of updated challenge that the Democratic Party faces.
And that's not going to be easy, because these things are normally hashed out in the course of a campaign to find a presidential candidate.
Well, but that's why these 2 years are very important. The Democrats were very effective in 1991 and 1992 in laying the groundwork in Congress for Clinton's presidential campaign, for instance, by picking fights on health care, which then Clinton made his theme. What the Democrats have to do, it seems to me, in the next 2 years is have a very robust internal debate about what that story is, but also put forward legislative initiatives that focus the public's attention on those things, not with the belief that they're going to pass, but with the belief that they can start to enter the intellectual bloodstream, and then the Democratic nominee can pick up on them.
So not with the belief that they're going to pass, or they're going to pass bills they know aren't going anywhere, that President Bush will veto, and that they're not going to be able to override.
Yes, that's right. I think one has to be realistic. We hear all this talk about bipartisanship, and there may be some areas where there can genuinely be movement, but not a lot tends to happen in the last couple of years of a presidency. And the Democrats should not support legislation that they think is bad just so they can pass legislation. Their big opportunity, I think the wind is at the Democrats' back because of the collapse of the conservative ascendancy that started with Ronald Reagan, and the Democrats should be focusing on trying to set things up, tee things up, for their opportunity to make more gains in the Senate in 2008, which they very well may be able to do, and to take the White House, and then to move.
Mm-hmm. Here's another email, this from John in Durango, Colorado. The statement Nancy Pelosi made yesterday explains it all. He writes, if the Democrats want to continue to win, I am Speaker of the entire House. This is where the Republicans went wrong, alienating and demonizing them. They had already the majority and could win every vote if they wanted, but they didn't have to rub it in. If the Democrats are inclusive, giving everyone a chance to have input, they will make all the difference in the world. Not allowing Democrats on conference committee, not allowing amendments from Democrats, not allowing their input, those are the things that the voters rejected. Whichever party learns this lesson quicker will win in 2008. Do you agree?
Well, I do think that procedurally, certainly, the Democrats should try to be more open. I think they should also be reformist. Part of what the Republican Congress did was it really shut down avenues for open debate, which I think was very unhealthy and the American people did not like. But one has to be realistic. There are very big, remaining, profound ideological divisions between the Democrats and the Republicans. Let's take this minimum wage. Democrats want to raise the minimum wage. Most Republicans will say, at least as of last week, sure, raise the minimum wage, but only if you repeal the estate tax. Democrats, by and large, genuinely believe in the estate tax. They believe that it's actually central to the preservation of American meritocracy, that we do not have a kind of oligarchic caste of wealth that's passed on from generation to generation. And so I don't think the Democrats should be expected to compromise on that just so they can get bipartisan support for raising the minimum wage.
We're talking about ideological shifts within both political parties as a result of this year's elections. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Dave on the line. Dave calling from Rochester, New York.
Good afternoon, Neil, and good afternoon, Peter. You know, there's talk about maybe the Republican Party should go more to a centrist, area, you know, but back to where it supposedly was before Reagan became president. You know, they call them, you know, Rockefeller Republicans. But didn't Nelson Rockefeller in his later years in the 1970s do some things that outraged a lot of liberals that seem to have been forgotten, like how he massacred all those people at Attica, you know, one of the worst massacres in the United States in the 20th century, and he put in effect the nation's first life imprisonment drug laws. And he went after people on welfare, you know, slashing of benefits.
Dave, why are we debating the legacy of Nelson Rockefeller, who's been dead, I think, 12 years?
Well, because they keep talking, you know, calling liberal Republicans Rockefeller Republicans. Why do they forget that? He also moved sharply to the right in his later years.
Mm-hmm. Let me put this question to Peter Beinart, and thanks very much, Dave, for the call. Moderate and liberal Republicans had a very bad day on Tuesday, and in fact, the Republican Party is smaller and more conservative. Indeed, the Democratic Party is larger, and at least on the congressional level, more conservative.
Yes, that's right. I think what Republicans should do is take a more honest look at the legacy of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was far less conservative than George W. Bush has been. Republicans don't want to hear that. But if they looked honestly at the legacy of Ronald Reagan, that would be a more moderate legacy. Reagan cut taxes dramatically in 81, but then he passed three tax hikes as he saw the budget deficit start to swell. Two of Reagan's three Supreme Court nominees, Anthony Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor, voted to uphold Roe v. Wade. Ronald Reagan in 1983, when Social Security was in much worse fiscal shape than it is now, didn't try to partially privatize it. He raised taxes and raised the retirement age to shore up its fiscal solvency. The truth of the matter is that George W. Bush has betrayed Ronald Reagan's legacy, but not in the way that conservatives say, because he's been too liberal. In fact, he has been much more ideologically extreme. Reagan had a much better intuitive sense for where the American center was, and that would be a better center for the Republicans to return to.
One last email, this from David. In 1994, the Congress went overwhelmingly Republican, in part because of a promise the government would be more fiscally conservative, open to debate on the floor, that the government would be held accountable to the same laws that regular citizens are held to. The committees would be public. The budget would be balanced. Those were the conservative issues the Republicans won on. They resonated strongly with centrist voters, and Democrats were forced to adopt them. Since 2000, these issues had fallen to the wayside as Republicans depended increasingly on a neoconservative political movement and radical Christian conservative ideology. Democrats are, ironically, David writes, now the more centrist party and a party more devoted to the Republican contract with America.
Well, I do think the Democratic Party is the more centrist party ideologically, but I think that the very important point that's being made has to do with the importance of reform. Republicans, it's true, Republicans won in 1994 because of the promise of reform. That was very, very important to them. Now it turns out that this issue of corruption and reform is very important to the Democrats' victory. The success the Democrats will have will be very much connected to whether they are seen to keep faith with that desire for reform and not slip back into the bad old ways of Washington. That's why I think it's critically important that they do something really aggressive on lobbying rules, on things like gerrymandering, on campaign finance, and not, for goodness sakes, not just recreate the relationship with K Street that Tom DeLay and the Republicans had with a new group of Democrats. If they do that, the American people will feel betrayed and Republicans will be poised for a comeback, particularly with John McCain, who, of course, is associated with this idea of political reform.
Peter Beinart, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Peter Beinart, editor of The New Republic and now a resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. He joined us by phone from his office here in Washington. When we come back from a break, Richard Viguerie will join us and discuss these issues from the conservative point of view. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, plus the FCC's new rulings on profanity. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News. Now let's continue our conversation about the tectonic shift of power here in Washington, D.C. Richard Viguerie is a conservative leader and a marketing consultant, as well as the author of Conservatives Betrayed, How Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause, and he joins us now on the line. Nice to speak with you again, sir.
Good to be with you again, Neil.
Do you believe the electorate was rejecting conservatism or Bushism?
Well, those who try to say this was a referendum on conservatism are trying to square a circle. It cannot be done. This administration for 6 years has governed as big government types. They've expanded the government almost at the level that Lyndon Johnson expanded it. There are very, very few conservatives in this administration. This is an administration of, by, for, and behalf of big government, big business. Since the 2004 election, the president's appointed two and only two conservatives to help him run the executive branch of the government. The initiatives that were all state ballots across the country, the overwhelming of them that were ideological between the left and the right were won by the conservatives. Most Republican candidates avoided the identifying themselves with the Kelo initiatives that were out there, with the same-sex marriage issues, and those almost entirely were very, very successful. And if they'd have identified themselves as conservatives, they'd have won. And interesting enough, the Democrats ran away from being identified as liberals. They were out there looking and running moderate candidates, right-of-center candidates, whether it's Jim Webb here in Virginia, Casey in Pennsylvania. So, you know, this was clearly a loss for George Bush, Karl Rove, Ken Melman, Denny Hastert, those who wanted to abandon their conservative principles that got them elected.
Do you think the war in Iraq was a driving issue?
Oh, absolutely. That would be the number one issue. And I'm just in a state of shock that the president yesterday sought Rumsfeld's resignation instead of doing it a month ago, and he could have kept the Congress and saved himself a lot of grief for the last 2 years of his presidency. Absolutely. The two things probably drove this as much as anything. Well, maybe three. The war in Iraq, clearly. Everybody's unhappy with the war. I'm unhappy with the war. And he violated his principles, by the way, in his campaign promises when he said in 2000, when he campaigned for president, he would not engage in nation building. Mm-hmm. He's become the biggest nation-building president in American history. Scandals. Both parties had their share of scandals, but the Republicans had more, and they were the party in power, so the people were just tired of all of this. And the third thing is that the left, the liberals, were energized to turn out, and the conservatives were discouraged and disheartened, and they did not turn out at the same level that the liberals did.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Chris. Chris with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Good afternoon, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Maybe this idea has already been expressed, but I was going to suggest that perhaps the results of the election were not necessarily so much a vote against conservatism, but against the extreme values and policies of the neoconservatives.
Would you agree with that, Richard Viguerie?
I'm sorry, what was the last thing? Did he say Neil?
He did.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I put out a press release yesterday in a press conference, talked about how the voters did reject the neocons philosophy. People think of usually as the neocons as being about foreign policy, and that is very much on their agenda. And the voters clearly rejected their idea of waging war in the Middle East and running around the world trying to remake the world in our image. But they're also big government types, and they believe in big government ever-expanding bureaucracy. And so across the board, they were rejected, in my opinion, the neocons. Mm-hmm. And in my book, Conservatives Betrayed, I talk about how all of the Republican leaders need to resign. And we saw Hastert starting that yesterday. But conservatives are not going to get to the political promised land until we get new leaders. We're like the biblical Jews who had to wander through the desert for 40 years until that generation of corrupt, immoral leaders had passed away. And conservatives are not going to get to our political promised land until we get new leaders. And that's new leaders in the House, in the Senate, in the Republican National Committees, and in the White House.
Mm-hmm. What about the influence of the religious right, which, again, some people say was a driving factor motivating Democratic voters this time around to come out and vote? And by the way, Chris, thanks for the call.
Well, if that's the case, the liberals didn't turn out in very large numbers, because the same-sex marriage initiative won resoundingly across the country, except for one state where it narrowly lost.
Arizona, yes.
Yes, and so the religious right voters did turn out. And if George Allen had made that a key part of his campaign, that issue got something like 58% support here in Virginia, and Allen got 49%. So he ran from that issue. And Republican candidates all over the country. The last caller was from Michigan. The Republican candidate for governor there opposed the affirmative action program. The voter said, we don't believe in reverse discrimination, and they resoundingly took a conservative position, and the Republican establishment took the liberal position.
All right, I could argue South Dakota and abortion, but we'll leave it there. But the other issue that comes up now is, what is the conservative position on the war in Iraq? How does the United States proceed from here?
Well, nobody knows how to get ourselves out of there. No one, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, believes you should cut and run now. The president has kind of the pottery barn example. I guess you break it, you buy it, you own it. And the president has broken Iraq there, and he has responsibility of figuring out how to get us out of there. And I don't have a magic wand. I'm not sure. I know that we need to get out now, sooner than later, not today, but we need to be about the business of pulling back and letting the Iraqis deal with their own issues there. America would be better off if every country was a democracy, but that's not consistent with our Constitution to allow us to wander throughout the world, remaking the world in our image.
Richard Viguerie, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Neil.
Richard Viguerie is the author of Conservatives Betrayed, How Big Government Republicans Hijacked the Conservative Cause. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about the FCC and those dirty words.